Funding for WBUR comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
Good evening, Boston. I'm Anne-Marie Lipinski. I'm the curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, a place where we help journalists help journalism. We do that through a fellowship program and through a portfolio of publishing initiatives. And we are so honored to be a part of the inaugural Hub Week, and I'm guessing you all are too. And we're especially happy to share tonight's program with our good colleagues, the Boston Globe and the Shorenstein Center at Harvard. On behalf of us all, I especially want to thank Nieman's Samantha Henry for leading the planning that went into tonight's event. Corralling writers is no easy work. Among the joys of being a Nieman Fellow is time to work on your craft. Combined with reporting, telling great stories is the coin of the journalism realm. The best writers I know are also the ones who most crave improvement. Helping us do that at the Nieman Foundation is Steve Allman, your Master of Ceremonies for tonight. Steve is Nieman's nonfiction narrative instructor and the author of 10 books, including the best-selling Candy Freak and his most recent Against Football, A Reluctant Manifesto. He has also been a frequent host of storytelling gatherings and slams around Boston. Lastly, and most importantly, I want to thank every single soul in this beautiful historic hall. You can tell stories to an empty room, but what's the fun in that? Please welcome Steve Allman.
I got to kiss her. That's my boss. I just kissed her. It was awesome. Yes, wow, what a great room. I've never been in this place. I'm clearly underdressed, but I said to my daughter before I went out, I knew that it was going to be in kind of a fancier place than I'm ever actually in my life. And so I said to her, well, she's nine. I said, do you think I should shave or should I kind of go with the rough and ready look? And she looked at me very seriously and she just said, Papa, how do you want to be remembered? Holy shit, I am going to shave. So I have shaved for you this evening. I need to tell you before we go any further, please turn off your devices. Some of you are probably even past cell phones at this point. It's just a chip or something. Whatever it is, turn it off if you could. The only acceptable use, you do not want to be the person, especially in the midst of a story that somebody's going to tell you where that thing buzzes. I mean, you know, pregnancy, hospitalization, tweeting about my shave, all of those are exemptions, but those are the only exemptions that you have tonight. So welcome to Made in Boston, Stories of Innovation and Invention. This is, as you probably know, part of Hub Week, which is a historic collaboration between Harvard, MIT, Mass General Hospital, and the Boston Globe. Tonight's event, in particular, is a joint production of Hub Week and the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, with support from the Globe, the Kennedy School, Shorenstein Center on Media, Politics, and Public Policy, and special thanks to Bank of America. The agenda for this evening is really pretty simple. You're going to hear seven stories told by some of Boston's most prominent innovators, journalists, and authors, with a 10-minute intermission halfway through the program. The intermission is free. We're not charging. Our goal for tonight is to gather a range of voices to come at the same basic theme, that of innovation and Boston itself, through storytelling. I think of stories as the most basic form of human invention. They're how we make meaning out of the world around us and sometimes inside of us. But stories themselves take a lot of different forms. Some are reported and brought to us by career journalists who are slaves to fact. That's the province of the Nieman, the Globe, and the Shorenstein Center. Other stories are ruminations about long-ago encounters that blur over time. And some storytellers work in the space between those two realms, trying to make sense of experiences that are both personal and public. The stories you hear tonight are about people and ideas that changed the world. Some of them are about moments that changed the storyteller. All of them are in some way a celebration of the spirit of innovation that energizes Boston. Your only job is to sit back and listen. I think you're going to have a lot of fun. Okay, the other thing I should mention about storytelling, these folks are not going to come up here with a script or something to read off of, unlike me, for instance. They are just going to be telling you a story, really not off the top of their head, but certainly one that is not a prepared text. And that's quite a frightening thing to do, especially in this beautiful, ornate building. So you have to give them a lot of love and support, which starts with cheering irrationally. Pretend you're at a Bernie Sanders rally. Or for a very small and hated portion of you, pretend you're at a Trump rally, okay? All right. Let me bring up our first storyteller. I'm so excited. I've been looking forward to this for quite a long time. His name is Joey Ito. He is the director of the MIT Media Lab. Perhaps you have heard of it, Hub Week. He's also chairman of the board of PureTech Health and a board member of Sony Corp and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Mozilla Foundation, and the New York Times Company. Basically, if you ever want to win a grant, be very nice to him. He's created numerous internet companies, including PSINet Japan, Digital Garage, and InfoSeek Japan. He was an early stage investor in Formlabs, Flickr, Kickstarter, Little Bits, Path, Twitter, and Wikia. He's been widely heralded as one of the most influential thinkers in technology and a leading advocate of internet freedom. In 2014, he was inducted into the South by Southwest Interactive Festival Hall of Fame and was awarded the Golden Plate Award by the Academy of Achievement. Yes! There is a thing in the world called the Academy of Achievement. Sadly, there is not a thing in the world called the Academy of Underachievement, but we're getting there. We're in the planning stages. I could keep going on and on about Joey's achievements for many hours. Instead, I'll just say how honored we are to have one of the true rock stars of innovation with us tonight. Please welcome with wild applause to the stage, Mr. Joey Ito.
Thank you for adjusting the mic. One of my earliest childhood memories was sitting in my bedroom as a real small kid with a book that my father gave me. And my father loved his classic books. And I would sit there flipping the pages, pretending to read, and daydream about other stuff. Because he was so insistent that these books would do to me what they did to him that he forced me to read a certain number of pages a night, and I would just pretend. And he thought vegetables were very important, so he physically would stick them in my mouth, which, as you can imagine, isn't the most effective way. And so, and I remember at dinner, he would suddenly get up in the middle of dinner without saying anything and go back to the lab to work on his experiment. So being at MIT, now having worked with a lot of kids on the spectrum, I realize in retrospect that my father is one of those. But as a kid, when I went to my dad asking for help with my math and science homework, because he was a PhD chemist, and his PhD was probably the thing he was most proud about, but he would aimlessly insist on the fact that my equal signs needed to be in a row, and eventually I stopped going to my dad for help because he just wasn't able to communicate with me. But he worked as a chemist in this amazing company called Energy Conversion Devices, which was founded by a high school dropout, genius material scientist. 75% of the people were PhDs. And I remember as a kid being in the room with Stan Obshinsky, and he'd sit there with styrofoam balls and pipe cleaners and jangle this model of a molecule and say, "See these dangling bonds? If we could just have germanium here, I think the conductivity would go up." And he was surrounded by Nobel Prize winners who would then scribble on the chalkboard these formulas and say, "This is what you're saying." And it was, to me, science was this wonderfully physical, artistic thing, and that's what I wanted to be when I grew up. And so when I went to college, and it turned out to be the same structured drill and grill that I was experiencing in high school, I dropped out and said, "This wasn't for me." That was Tufts. Sorry, Tufts. Well, Tufts thankfully gave me an honorary degree later. That was nice of them. it's courageous of them, too. And then later, so I dropped out and went back to ECD, where I met the head of the Chicago Physics Department, Helmut Fritschi, who was a wonderful man. And he said, Chicago's different. You should go there and study physics. So I went, studied physics, and in one of the first classes, I asked the teacher, explain magnetism to me in a more intuitive way so I can understand it physically. And he said, you can't. Memorize the formula. And I saw all these kids lined up memorizing the formula because they knew it was going to be on the test. And I said, this is not the science I'm looking for. So I dropped out of University of Chicago as well. And so at the same time, my sister's getting straight A's, Harvard magna cum laude, goes to Stanford, gets two PhDs in anthropology and education. And I decide this academia thing doesn't work for me. So I just started doing whatever I liked. And I went and became a professional DJ, an event coordinator, a television producer, an entrepreneur, a VC. And my sister, who was now a professor of learning, said, you are what we call an interest-driven learner. So at least I had a name, but my father, as you can imagine, was very, very disappointed with me and very, very happy with my sister. And when I dropped out the second time, he was very disappointed. Along the way, a little over 5 years ago, Nicholas Negroponte, the founder of the Media Lab, called me up and said, would you be interested in being the director of the Media Lab? And I said, as I do with anything new, I said, of course I'm interested. And so then he sent me an email a little while later saying, you know, we looked at your profile. You don't have a college degree. I think it's going to be kind of difficult. Don't hold your breath. But then apparently they went through a couple of hundred people and then ended up running out of prospects, and they went to the bottom of the barrel and they found me and said, hey, that guy, let's call him in. And so they called me in to MIT, and if you've been to MIT, it's a little bit daunting, especially for somebody who's never graduated from college. And then I got into the Media Lab, which is a shiny new building at the time, just done, and I almost walked out because it was just so impressive and so established that it didn't feel like me at all. But I decided, well, I'm here anyway, might as well take the interview. So I went and started meeting the students and the faculty for 2 days of marathon meetings, and it just blew my mind. If you've ever been to the Media Lab or know about it, it's a very weird place, even inside of MIT, which itself is pretty weird. It's the only lab that has its own academic program, which is called Media Arts and Sciences. So the first thing we do is we align the projects with the academics, which basically means we eliminated all the classes. Or the lectures, and people learn through doing. And we have 26 groups working on everything from learning to robots to synthetic biology, and everybody is learning through doing. We often say learning through construction rather than instruction. So this is a whole place full of interest-driven learners. And after the interview, it turned out that they were in love with me as much as I was in love with them, and so we quickly closed the deal, and I took the job as director of the Media Lab. And I remembering that my dad was a high school rugby captain. And, you know, I thought, finally, I've done something that he's probably going to be proud of. So I sent him an MIT rugby shirt. And then I heard through the grapevine that he was, like, wearing it everywhere. And it actually made me kind of feel weird because I felt like, wait, you don't deserve that. You didn't help me. And at some point, I had realized I had severed my ties with my father, who I felt was disappointed in me, who didn't help me and was never there for me, and that I was mama's boy, right? So then a few years go by, and I'm going through and doing these commencement speeches for my students. And we have about 150 students, but a bunch of them graduate each year. And I was sitting in a place like this, and you see the kids, and half the parents are international, first of all, and of them, a huge percentage are in America for the first time ever. And there are all these proud parents and these kids. And then I said, you know the story, the movie, The X-Men, and some of them, most of them knew what that was. I don't know if you guys know The X-Men. And I said, remember, it's about these kids who grew up in these normal little towns, and they have these weird powers, like the ability to turn something on fire, the ability to freeze something, and they're kind of freaks. And they have a hard time, and it's really hard. And then finally, they end up in this school where they realize these things they have are superpowers, and they're going to work together to save the world. And suddenly, they're no longer freaks. They're superheroes. And I said, those are you guys. And you're about to go back into a world of normal people, and they will look at you as if you're freaks. But you've got to remember what you learned. Stick together and save the world. That's my speech. And so the kids are all nodding their head, yeah, okay. And the parents are crying. And... And what I realized, two things. When I was looking at the kids, I realized these kids are kind of like my dad. I mean, nothing personal, but they're, most of them are somewhere on the spectrum. And so I realized after training them, wait, my dad didn't know any better. And then I look at the parents who are crying, and I realize how hard it must be to raise a kid that you don't understand. And I started feeling bad for my dad. And so I heard he was coming to town, and so for the first time in my life, I asked my dad out for a drink. And I told him I wanted to talk to him, and I don't know if he was nervous, but we went to this place called Back Bar in Somerville, and I sat down and told my dad, you know, it was really hard. I mean, stuffing vegetables down my throat, what were you thinking? You know, and I was going on and on about how his disappointment was so hurtful, and I don't know how much got through to him. He was listening, he was happy, but what was really important for me was, for the first time in my life, I told him, you know, I forgive you and I appreciate you. And I think for the first time in my life, I actually felt that. So thank you.
That's Joe Ito. Wow. What a beautiful story. And also, if anybody is wondering if we're on the spectrum, he knows. You can just come up to him and he just will be able to immediately sense it. That was beautiful. Okay, our next storyteller is Lori Penny. She is a celebrated author and journalist from London, England. She's published 4 books, most recently Unspeakable Things, Sex, Lies, and Revolution. How many people would like to buy that book? I think I would. Okay. Lori is a contributing editor at The New Statesman and a contributor to The Guardian, Vice, and The Nation. She's reported from the front lines of new social movements in Britain, Canada, Greece, Spain, Egypt, and the U.S. She blogs at Penny Red and is a regular commentator on youth and politics and women's issues for the BBC. A few years back, the Daily Telegraph called Penny, quote, without a doubt, the loudest and most controversial female voice on the radical left, which I certainly hope she took as a compliment. Lori graduated from Oxford University with a degree in English literature. She was a Nieman Fellow last year, and I was lucky enough, yes, I was lucky enough to teach her, or perhaps she was teaching me. We never quite figured that out. Either way, I'm so psyched to be in the presence of her awesomeness again. Ladies and gentlemen, please give it up for Miss Lori Penny.
So there are some moments in your life which you know you're always going to remember because they're of special significance to you personally. And there are some moments which you know you're always going to remember because it was a special date in history and you just happened to be there and remember. And then there are some where the two collide. And the story I'm going to tell today is one of those moments, which is why, despite having outsourced almost all my medium-term memory to my phone, I can remember exactly when it was. It was almost exactly four years ago, and it was the 30th of September, 2011, and I was halfway up a set of scaffolding on my first day in New York City, watching a bunch of Occupy Wall Street protesters about to get their heads kicked in by the NYPD. And I stood there on this scaffolding, and at this point I should back up and tell you that I like to climb things. I'm sort of known for it, which is, you know, when you're a really short person, you develop a lot of upper body strength, because, I don't know, maybe you know about this, even smaller microphone, but you know, you have to climb up things as a kid to get stuff, and sometimes you have rubbish little sisters who are taller than you and put things up on high shelves where you can't see them because they think it's funny. Anyway, you get a lot of upper body strength. You learn to climb things, and I had at this stage been reporting on protests and youth movements for a couple of years. It was how I got my start. And if you're a short person at a protest, you're really not going to see a lot unless you get up high. So I had developed a reputation for climbing lampposts, bus stops, tall friends, really anything that would hold me. And some people referred to me as a protest monkey, which I quite liked. And so anyway, I was hanging off this set of scaffolding, and I showed one of the other, a very tiny, although very eminent, American reporter who I just met, a young guy, how to climb up this scaffolding with me. And I was standing next to him, or rather kind of dangling next to him, and these kids were walking by underneath, and the police officers stopped them from marching on Wall Street, which is what they wanted to do. And everybody was very shocked and upset at this. And this was my first day in New York, and having just come from Britain, I was astonished that anybody thought that these kids were going to be allowed to march on Wall Street. I mean, you can't do that. Honestly, I mean, maybe there's not a law against it, but really, what did they expect? Come on, come on. And then they started to do something which was astonishing to me. At Occupy Wall Street, they made a lot of interesting hacks and community hacks, the first one of which was the human mic, because the powers that be decided that one way they were going to tamp down on this protest, which they couldn't legally move, really, was that we're going to ban the use of sound amplification. So instead, all the people there decided to do a thing where they would, whoever was speaking would repeat, would shout a phrase, and then everybody would repeat it back to them, the human mic. And so they started, one person, and I cannot remember who it was, I wish I could, started chanting something, and everybody started chanting it back. And it was, Congress shall make no law. Congress shall make no law. Respecting the right of the people. Respecting the right of the people. And I was like, to the guy next to me, I said, what is that? And he said, it's the First Amendment. And I was like, wow. America is really into itself. which is true, right? I mean, it's not that Britain isn't a mad patriotic place, but we don't, like, sort of advertise it. That's one of the first differences you notice in a place like between, like, London and somewhere like Boston or New York, is that in London, you never, if you see anybody going around in one of those I Love London T-shirts, you know instantly that that person's not from London, because you don't do that. In Boston, people wear the Boston hats who are actually from here. It astonishes me. It really does. I, you know, why would you advertise your feelings about about the place you grew up in? Yeah, it's nonsense to me. But anyway, this was when I started to realize that there was something very different, not just about America's ideas of itself, but also its ideas of speech and its idealism around journalism, because I stayed at Occupy Wall Street, having turned up there with no money and no plan, following that protest instinct to see, you know, maybe there's something really high I can climb in America. One of the first things that I realized is that there were a lot of other young journalists from around my age who'd come to get their start at Occupy Wall Street because we just knew something massive was happening. Something huge was occurring that would change the way we thought about activism, about storytelling, and about what the future could be. And this was entirely true. And one of the things we learned, as well as being idealists and young people and all that awesome, you know, stuff that they write songs and films about and then try to sell back to us, we were also young journalists trying to build a career. And we realized that out there at Occupy Wall Street, the story that we were seeing was not the story that was being reported by our our newspapers. The story was different, and a lot of us weren't even working for newspapers. We were young bloggers or podcast hosts or freelancers, and suddenly we didn't have a team. Suddenly we weren't in a mainstream media club, even those of us who were technically stringing for the New York Times. And we realized that we had to learn techniques from activism, even though we weren't activists ourselves. And so we decided to do something. A bunch of us, about 10 to 15 of us, we decided to do something that we'd learned from watching the activists at Occupy Wall Street and me from watching people in London previously, which was we formed an affinity group. And an affinity group is very simple. It's a bunch of, it came out of the anarchist movement, and it's a bunch of people who decide we're going to an event or a protest and we're all going to stick together and we're going to agree beforehand what the parameters are. Can we get arrested? No. Anybody feel like getting arrested today? No. All right then. So we'll probably run in that direction when it happens. And it's a way of organizing action fast and changing with a changing situation. And we realized that we needed a team, and we couldn't be either ethically or practically in a team with a bunch of activists. The most important reason for this is that if you're in a protest situation and the police come charging at you, the journalists are the only ones who are going to be running towards them. And it was a matter of direction. And this had been a problem for me before, trying to report on protests. And, you know, people would be pulling me back, and I'd be going, no, 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 I have to get this picture. I have to see what's happening, even if I get hit in the head. It's fine. So we formed our affinity group. And that affinity group kept going even as we saw Occupy Wall Street dismantled, even as many of us moved around the world covering different events, and as our careers took us off in different directions, we realized that there was something changing, not just in politics, but in journalism, because a massive crisis of capitalism had run smack bang into a huge change in communications technology, and I'm sure any of you who work in technology and media can see the ripple of effects of that only growing. But what it meant for us is we completely had to revisit what it meant, who our team was, and what it meant to have a team. And for me, this is a journey I'm still on. The intervening 3 years were a kind of endless, frenetic, knackering journey of going around the world, going back and back to America, because this place fascinates me. It's so weird. Covering protest movements at home, going around Europe, and trying to figure out where my line was in between advocacy journalism, and activism. And that's a line that people argue about in different ways, in different countries, which is something that fascinates me. In America, it is not done at all to be a member of a political party in some newspapers. I briefly had a job at a newspaper called The Morning Star in London, which has the distinction of being the oldest and only daily English language communist newspaper in the world. Which was next to a chicken factory out on Fish Island in London, and we are the only British outlet, or we were the only British outlet which covers Northern Ireland as part of the foreign desk, and which is one of the things that taught me that all journalism in its way is advocacy journalism. But it was a tiring time and an exhausting time. And I spent a lot of it looking frantically for that team and wondering where my affinity group was and who my team was going to be. And eventually, a friend passed me the number of the Nieman Foundation, and I applied on the off chance. And I remember when James and Anne-Marie called me to ask me if I was really sure that this fellowship was for me, the last thing they asked me was, are you sure that you're a journalist and not an activist? Are you sure that this is the right thing for you? And I said, yes, I'm a journalist first, but mostly I just want a year where people aren't shouting at me for being insufficiently Marxist. And so I came to Boston, and in Boston I thought I would be entirely by myself in the, as I'm sure many of the Neimans know, you think you're going to be the only one who's quite like you in this gang of fellows from all over the world. And I thought, well, nobody's going to quite understand me and my position on journalism, and nobody's quite going to understand what it means to be together is changing. And what I experienced very quickly is that we became a new affinity group. We developed community in a different way. And I'm sorry if that sounds cheesy, and maybe America is getting to me. And really, like, this is the bit where tiny violins play, and I say that, yeah, we're all still in contact, and, you know, we love each other, and we're setting up programs outside our newspapers because we know that what journalism means and what storytelling means and what politics means is changing. And it doesn't matter who your team is, as long as you have one and you have that backing and that community and that support. It's been vital for me. I'm really, really happy to be staying around in Cambridge for a little bit. And a bit of me is always going to be a protest monkey and is always going to be climbing things to look at the way, it, to watch the crowd move. But I'm really happy that there are a lot of people now dangling beside me, even though it's precarious. And that's my story.
That's Lori Penny. You guys missed, before you all came in, she was literally just at the very top of that. It's dangling. All right, how's everybody doing? I love you. I love you, and later I want to make love to you. Okay, our next storyteller is Kara Miller. She's the host and executive editor of the public radio show Innovation Hub. Yes. This is the room where she should be getting a lot of love for Innovation Hub. She launched that program in 2011. PRI took the program national in May of 2014. The show, as many of you know, explores how creative ideas are pushing us forward in healthcare, education, culture, and beyond. Guests have included Sal Khan, Sherry Turkle, Marissa Meyer. Is that Mayer? I probably said that wrong. I'm sorry. Steve Wozniak and Michael Pollan. Prior to working in radio, Kara served as a television commentator on WGBH and NECN and was an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Her writing has appeared in the Boston Globe, the Atlantic.com, the International Herald Tribune, and elsewhere. She also contributes to The Takeaway, hosted by John Hockenberry, and WGBH's Morning Edition. Please welcome to the stage Miss Kara Miller.
So I want to take you back to a day in 2011. I was guest hosting a show, and we were very much in the throes of a really difficult economy. So there was this idea for the segment, for a segment of a show, and the idea was to try to find a recent college grad or maybe somebody who had recently finished grad school, and like they couldn't find the job they wanted. So they said, well, the heck with it, I'm going to create my own job. So I sent out a couple emails to friends, and I said, do you know anybody who fits this description? And I was hoping by the end of the day to get, like, a name back that we could put on the show. By the end of the day, we were deluged. There was a woman who had started her own law firm, somebody had started a jewelry company, an engineer who couldn't find the stuff he wanted, so he opened his own shop and started making it. Of course, people making apps. And I started thinking, like, maybe there's more to this innovation story than has been covered, and especially, like, this innovation spirit in Boston. So I thought, you know, we should do a show about this. So I pitched the idea for the show, and we started. Oh, it was a small, local, 7 a.m. on Saturday, one-hour radio show. But the sort of catch was is that I was the least likely person that you could probably imagine to cover innovation. I was an assistant professor of English at UMass, and it is absolutely true when I tell you I actually started my doctoral work and not just started, did 3 years of it, thinking I was going to be a medievalist. So I'm being like really innovative. So I can tell you, not well, and I'm hoping there's no medievalists here, the beginning of like the Canterbury Tales, Juan that Aprile with the Shorosota, but algorithms, AI, like I couldn't tell you. But it was so exciting that everybody I met, everybody I talked to became my teacher, right? I was learning from people who were doing medical studies. I was learning from people who were computer scientists. So I'm doing the show, and over time it gets a little bit bigger, and I'm working nights and I'm working weekends. And eventually I had this problem, which was that I had 2 full-time jobs, and you can only do that for so long before you start to lose it. And I was getting there because, you know, when you're working at 10 p.m. on Saturday night, you know something has gone wrong. So I had to figure out which of these 2 paths I was going to choose. And the allure of the academia path was pretty clear. I liked doing it, and also if you kept going, you like knew where it was going. Media, you don't know what the heck is going on. You don't know what the heck's going on tomorrow. But it was so exciting to be the student all the time and to learn new things every day that I ended up quitting my job teaching English and doing this whole show innovation hub thing. And one of the interesting things that happened pretty early on is that as I started talking to people, and we occasionally have segments where we talk about people who have been innovative in history, H.J. Heinz, Walt Disney, Estee Lauder, and some of these people are really, Joy talked about, on the spectrum. H.J. Heinz is off the spectrum. He didn't just count his ketchup. He counted everything, every step he took. He never could be an uneven weight. That was unacceptable. He had a hat that he would put on that would bump him up to the next pound. But one of the interesting things about learning about these people was that you learned that they always said no when other people said yes, and they always said yes when other people said no. They saw industries that didn't exist and knew that they could exist. And I started thinking about our system of education, which here we are in Boston, Horace Mann, right, the father of public education. We started, propagating these systems of public education that were really, really good at training people to work in factories, to do clerical work, jobs that existed, by the thousands when these schools were created and that, as you know, have been disappearing. I realized that here we were in Boston, this place that had created the structure, and it also had to be the place that broke apart the structure. So fast forward a couple of years, I was sitting in a theater in downtown Boston, actually the Modern Theater, which some of you may know, in the Theater District, and I was sitting on stage. We were doing a live show, and one of the panelists, this guy, this physics professor from Harvard, Eric Mazur, got up, and he gave like a 4-minute lecture to the audience on statistics. This is like public radio crowd, so I mean, they listen and everything. And at the end of the lecture, he said, well, given what I've told you, what's the likelihood it's going to rain in Chicago? Like, take a second to think about it. So people took a second to think about it. And then he said, I'm not going to tell you the answer. I want you to turn to the person next to you, find the person nearest to you who disagrees with you, and convince them that you're right. And I think for 5 seconds, people were like, what? And then everybody did it, and the place like erupted in sound. People were so into it. They all of a sudden, they really owned what they were saying. They were trying to convince some person they never knew, that there was a 30% chance it was going to rain in Chicago. No, it was 60%, and they were having these big arguments. People actually would come up to me a week later and say, I'm telling you, I still know I was right, even though they were wrong. I was on stage, but I was so excited by what was happening in the audience, I actually turned to the guy next to me who was also on the panel, and I was like, I have an idea. Do you want to, like, try to do this too, even though this is for the audience? And he was the president of Olin College, and he looked at me, and he was like, sure. But the only thing I should tell you is I was a professor of statistics, so I'd like no chance, you know. I mean, he already knew the answer. But the reason that Eric Mazur started teaching this way, the reason that he completely upended his way of teaching, was that one time he had given a physics quiz to his students, and it was unlike any physics quiz they'd ever seen. There were no equations, nothing looked like anything from the book. It was just sort of, if you went outside and you saw this thing fall or you saw these two cars hit each other, what would that show you about different things in physics? And he very quickly realized that even the people who were getting A's in his class didn't know physics. They didn't understand anything he had been teaching. I mean, they were getting A's, like I said, but they didn't know, they didn't understand it deeply. And he said, well, this is not good. I'm going to have to change the way things are going. None of that I lecture and you take notes thing. And I think upending teaching has to be part of what we do. And getting people to be so exuberant about learning the way people were in terms of what's the percentage of chance it's going to rain in Chicago, that has to be the direction we go in. Because it turns out we all have these jobs now, or many, many of us have jobs, and more, I think, where you have to learn all the time. I was talking to a graphic designer just a few weeks ago, and he was saying to me, when he was first trained, it was training to do graphic design for print. And then people were like, forget doing that. We're doing it for desktops. And then people were like, forget doing that. We're doing it for laptops. And people were like, yeah, forget it. Everybody's on mobile. And he had to keep learning all this new software. And more than that, he had to keep rethinking his job, graphic design. What was the point of all this stuff? So I think we've created these boxes, and Boston is at the epicenter of smashing the boxes. And I'll give you one example of a great Boston mind that's smashing the boxes. MIT grad Alice Brooks. I was talking with her just a couple months ago, and she was telling me that almost 20 years ago, she was 8, and she asked for a Barbie for Christmas. And then she heard through the grapevine that Santa does not bring Barbies. And so when Christmas came, she did get a present. It was a saw. So she took the saw and built her own dollhouse because nobody was buying it for her. And not surprisingly, years later, she got a degree in mechanical engineering from MIT. And after she was done with her schooling, she thought, you know, the way that girls and boys play with toys are so different. Boys play with all these spatial toys like Tonka trucks and stuff, and they build, you know, like starships out of Legos, Lego kits and stuff. And they're putting things together, and then they're smashing them apart, and they're putting them together, and they're understanding how systems work. Girls tend to play with dolls with, you know, like they can comb their hair and put on makeup and the different fashion. It's a lot more storytelling. And she said, I don't understand why engineering can't be girly. So what she does now, not kidding, professionally, she builds dollhouses. And they're kits, and you buy them. And you can put them together yourself. And little girls do. And they have, like, you have to put together all the panels on the dollhouse. But you also have to put together the circuits, the axles, the arches. So kids have made out of these kits the Golden Gate Bridge with LED lights strung through it. They've made car washes with spinning brushes for toy cars to go through. They've made regular dollhouses, but with elevators to take the dolls upstairs and downstairs. And what she did was she overturned something we totally expect to be normal. And doing that kind of thing, overturning expectations, changing education is hard. But Boston is going to do it. It's hard at work on it, and it's going to nurture that next generation of innovators. And the poignant thing for me is that I quit my job in education to cover innovation. And when I came to cover innovation, education became, to me, the single most important story I discovered. Thanks.
All right, that's Kara Miller.
I'm just in astonishment that there are dollhouses with elevators. I'm still there somehow. What a beautiful story. I guess basically you're still teaching is what it comes down to, just in a different way. That's what it is. All right, our next storyteller, Hiawatha Bray, is a business reporter and columnist covering the high-tech industry for the Boston Globe. He formerly covered banking and technology as a reporter for the Detroit Free Press. He's also written for Wired, Fast Company, and Black Enterprise. He began his career in journalism at Computer People Monthly. I don't know if you remember that magazine. Had a very interesting pitch line. The pitch line was, "We will tell you about the computer people, but only monthly. You have to wait a month." Hiawatha received an award from the Overseas Press Club for his series on the Internet and Africa, and while at the Free Press, he was awarded a Jefferson Fellowship for the study of Asian business and politics at the East-West Center in Honolulu. Nice. Nice gig. Bray is also the author of You Are Here, a book about the modern history of navigation, which was published in 2014 by Basic Books. Please welcome to the stage Mr. Hiawatha Bray.
Thank you all, ladies and gentlemen. The center, or at least the start of my story, came to me not too long ago when I was sitting on the subway, talking to my wife on the phone about something or other, and noticing that there was a guy staring at me, a scruffy-looking guy, the kind of guy I figured it was probably going to hit me up for some money. He was looking for a touch. Grizzled gray hair and a scruffy beard and cut-off jeans, and I didn't know what to make of him. I was sitting here thinking, why is this guy staring at me? And I hung up the phone, stopped talking to my wife, and he looked at me and said, "I thought it was you. I recognized the voice." And I realized, what is he talking about? I said, you're on the radio. You're on TV. I know you. And I just wanted to say, I love your work. I learned so much, and I just want to say hello and thank you. And I realized at that moment something that it's taken me so many years to learn, that I'm not as alien and weird and out of it as I sometimes think, that I have found here in Boston a home, a community where I am welcomed and where I don't have to feel as though I'm an alien and an outsider, even though that's how I arrived here, as an exile, fleeing as fast as I could from a failed marriage and a collapsed job. I was at the Detroit Free Press back in 1995, which was actually a very interesting place to be. For one thing, of course, this was back in the days when newspapers actually made money. I mean, it was amazing. They made a profit. Unfortunately, we made the mistake of asking to share some of it, and they objected. So there was a strike, and it didn't quite work out. But while I was there, 1995 was a seminal year, actually. It was at that year that the Internet really began to take off. That's the year Netscape went public, and they privatized this network in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which was at the backbone of the Internet. And I went to my editors, and I said, we need to start covering this. We need to start writing about it. And so I became the Free Press's technology reporter and had the time of my life. Mr. Ito, I spent more than a few occasions talking to Stanford Ovshinsky over at the company we were talking about, energy conversion devices. Wonderful experience. And so when that crisis happened, and I realized that the Detroit Free Press was no longer the place for me because I was not going to cross the picket line, I started casting about looking for another job, and somehow an opportunity opened up here in Boston. And of course, I just knew. This is where it all began. This is where it started. This is the very birthplace of so many of the technologies I wanted to write about. And I figured, if I'm going to be in exile, I'm going to be in exile there. I did not expect to find love. I did not expect to find companionship or friendship. I expected to find MIT and Harvard and, well, those of you who are old enough to remember, I expected to find Digital Equipment Corporation. And, well, we all know how that worked out. And I did find a great deal of that. This was back in the day when it seemed as though Boston was going to become as competitive in these fields as Silicon Valley. That didn't quite work out, and yet we still had so many of the greatest thinkers, so many of the greatest innovators, and I got to meet them. And then the ones who weren't based here kept passing through because they had to be in Boston. Bill Gates and Andy Grove, who back in the day was running Intel, and who is, by the way, perhaps the most scary smart human being I've ever met in my life, or the wonderful cynicism of people like Scott McNeely, who founded Sun Microsystems. People like that, I was in the midst of them, and I got to talk to them and learn from them, and it was a magnificent experience. And yet, all the while, I knew this somehow wasn't quite enough. It was not enough. I was still not really at home. Here I am, some guy with an economics degree who didn't really understand a lot of what I was writing about, and people, I thought, were merely putting up with me, patronizing me. I guess it was my imagination. I worked day in, day out, constantly writing by day and interviewing by day, going home and playing computer games by night, endless rounds of computer games. Yes, I was one of those people. But going to church on Sundays, in much the same way that I became a journalist in the first place. Going to church and being a journalist were really somehow connected in my mind, because both of them were an attempt to become human. I became a journalist in large part because I wanted to be human. It was an attempt to get out of the cage that I built for myself. I felt I had to reach out to the rest of the world. And this would be a career that would basically force me to do it. And it did work to a limited extent. The same thing about church. I was a Christian believer, still am. And I knew you could not be a Christian alone. I had to find a church. I found People's Baptist Church. 830 Tremont, if you want to drop in. 210 years old, one of the oldest black churches in America, as a matter of fact, built by freed slaves and freedmen. Wonderful place. But everybody there knew there was something wrong. Much as I loved to be there and sing the hymns and say the prayers, nevertheless, people thought I was cold and distant and unfeeling, and there was a lot of truth to that. My pastor thought there was really something wrong, and I think there was too, and I didn't realize how much wrong there was until about 10 years ago when I was in a hotel in Brookline, and I met Miss Zaire of 1981. Miss Zaire of 1981, who herself was an exile, who had come fleeing to Congo from the terror of death that awaited her in her native land. I mean, in her native land, she had been something that I wasn't. I grew up a poor kid. My parents were like basically sharecroppers from the deep south, you know, lucky to have $2 to rub together. She lived in an affluent family in Congo. She went to a school when she learned five languages and studied Greek and Latin and traveled around the world and became a manager at one of the largest hotels in Congo. And then she had to flee as a refugee. And she stumbled across me, a refugee from Detroit, which was just about as bad. And we came together and came to love each other and came to marry each other. And it was like being reintroduced to a part of humanity that I never really had before, that had, even in a previous marriage, not really fully taken hold of me. And she took hold of me in other ways, too. I mean, first of all, she planned the wedding. It was a wonderful affair. And in the process, she introduced me to the whole Congolese community here in Boston. There is a community of hundreds of Congolese who live here, many of them refugees. And I came to know them as they helped put together our wedding. And then my wife, interested in doing more than what she was doing at her job, she's an admin at MIT, decided that she wanted to do wedding planning and wedding photography. But, you know, there's this funny thing about doing photography. You have to learn how to work the camera. And, you know, I'm one of these technology guys, and so you know the rule. We all say RTFM. I'm not going to tell you what it stands for. And whenever somebody doesn't know how to do things, you say, come on, read the manual. She didn't want to be bothered. So that was my job. She focused on working to achieve the beauty of the effects she was trying to do at these wedding events and at the fashion shows that she also shot. And she said, you've got to read the manuals. You've got to show me how the cameras work. You've got to teach me this stuff. And so all the technology-friendly brain that I had was turned onto a different kind of problem, learning how to take f-stops and ISO readings and all the other technical minutiae of cameras and photography and turn it into beauty, into capturing the essence of a moment, into capturing something that would convey meaning and feeling to other people when they saw it. And it gave me a sense of direction. It gave me a connection to the technologies that I'd written about that I'd never previously had, that drew me into it in a way that was new to me, that made it more human, that made it more personal. And along the way, I got to see so much of the culture of this area. I spent so many days, so many nights shooting weddings of people from Congo and Haiti. I especially loved the Greek Orthodox wedding we did. For some strange reason, if you were doing a Greek Orthodox wedding, you put the wedding cake onto plates, then you go out onto the dance floor and you throw the plates onto the dance floor, cake and all, and then dance through the smeary cake all over the floor. I don't know why the Greeks do it. I mean, it didn't seem to me they were drinking any more than any of the other weddings I saw, but this was something they insisted on doing. Well, we even shot a bat mitzvah once, something that was totally new to me, but absolutely fascinating, and it showed me how much of the world I had been cutting myself off from and how much wonder and delight and pleasure there was in the world. And I got to see it through the eyes of my wife. Also along the way, I got to learn about the joys of fashion photography. Absolutely. My wife does fashion photography as well. We have the annual bikini shoot at the beach, which she insists on my going to. And it always makes me a little bit nervous because I feel, come on, I'm a Baptist. We're not supposed to do that. But she insisted I come with her because otherwise drunken people walking along the beach will interrupt as all these women in bikinis are standing around. And I said, okay, baby, I'm your husband. I'll be there for you. And it usually works out. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. It's the old saying, people ask photographers for magazines like Playboy, how do you do that and not be distracted? It's easy because you are paying attention to the technique and getting everything right, and that becomes your focus. I was a little uncomfortable about it also because in time I became a deacon at my church, and I still am. And that's been very important to me. I, by the way, asked the head of the deacon board, should I be doing this fashion photography with my wife? And he said, can I come along? So I thought, so I figure I've got their permission to do that. I have to wrap up. We're running out of time. I just want to wrap up by conveying the fact that being made a deacon played a very important role in what really changed me, because it came to me that I had to trust God more, and that being put in this city with that woman and with all the experiences that I have had is not an accident. I'm here for a reason, and that reason is to make contact with people, to go beyond the mere writing about technology, to understand the heart and soul of what lies behind everything that everyone I write about is actually doing. And I've begun to do that, and little by little become more a part of this community, more accepting of other human beings, more welcoming to the greetings that I get on subway trains and walking down the street than I ever thought I would be. Thank you very much.
It's Hiawatha Bray. I know it's wrong, but I want to see him in a bikini. I just want to. You can't stop me. All right, listen, we're going to take a short 10-minute break. Hang around, and Hiawatha was speaking with great eloquence about connecting to people and so forth. If you liked those fantastic stories you heard, feel free to come up and tell the storytellers that you enjoyed what they had to say and connect with them a little bit. We'll be back in 10. Okay, so everybody in the hall almost entirely is sitting down. Almost everybody. And there she is, as if she's wearing the cloak of invisibility. Nobody can see you, ma'am. Nobody. None of the 500 people here could see you. Okay, our next storyteller is Judy Norsegian. She is the former executive director and also co-founder of Our Bodies, Ourselves. Formerly, yes! Formerly called the Boston Women's Health Book Collective. She's the co-author of Our Bodies, Ourselves, and a member of the editorial teams for Our Bodies, Ourselves Menopause and Our Bodies, Ourselves Pregnancy and Birth. I am personally hoping she comes up with an Our Bodies, Ourselves Middle-Aged Depression volume. We'll see if that happens. Judy has been speaking and writing about a wide range of women's health concerns for close to 45 years and has appeared everywhere from the Today Show to the NBC Nightly News to Oprah. She has served on the board of the National Women's Health Network and received numerous awards, including being named one of, quote, 21 leaders for the 21st century by Women's News, as well as an honorary doctorate from Boston University. Please welcome to the stage Judy Noor Sejan.
Thank you so much, Steve. Well, it's a real pleasure to join you. And I want to say my story is really the story about a group, not just about me. Some of you probably have a copy of Our Bodies Ourselves, one of the 9 editions that's out there. And it may be sitting on your shelf somewhere. In fact, the 1970 edition is back there if you want to see the newsprint rumpled up. But you may not know that it was created right here in Boston. In fact, the story of the founding of this organization in this book is really quite satisfying. Go back more than 46 years to Emmanuel College, and don't ask me how a Catholic girls' school allowed a women's liberation conference to be held talking about these topics, but in May of 1969, at this conference, a workshop was held in which several dozen women gathered together in a classroom and began to talk, many of them for the very first time, about some deeply personal health issues, sexuality issues, things that they'd never talked about alone, let alone in a conference setting. The stories erupted. Some women had bad doctor stories to tell. And of course, if you go back to that era, you're going to see a lot of sexism, condescension, paternalism. Many women who asked questions were told, you know, don't worry your pretty little head. And of course, that's not going to give you good medical care if you can't talk about your symptoms, right? But one of the things that also happened is that women began to get angry about the situation that they faced, not just their treatment, but also their own profound ignorance about their bodies. One woman got up and said, you know, I had a baby. I didn't really know what happened. I'm there in the postpartum room thinking about what just happened. And in comes the doctor and he says, I sewed you up nice and tight as a favor for your husband. And she started wondering, what is this about? Of course, it was probably an unnecessary episiotomy to begin with. But the women in this group began to understand that they couldn't put together a good doctor's list, which was the first project that summer. They had to educate themselves. They had to know more about their bodies. And they began with going to Countway Medical Library here at Harvard Medical School, talking to physicians and nurses who were receptive to their questions, and starting to write down what they learned, and then got together in small groups to share what they had learned. And then women started adding their stories to the information that had been collected. And this is the way this genre of writing was created, that combined factual information with personal experience, and by making sure that women's voices would be heard. Now, you have to imagine, too, that early on, this was primarily about demystification. We didn't know very much about health and medical care. But as those of us in Our Bodies Ourselves began to learn more, we understood that we have to go beyond demystification and basic information to understand more about safety and efficacy of the drugs and the devices and the procedures, surgical procedures, that were so often used in women's health care. And it wasn't long before we learned that there wasn't much evidence for a lot of what was done. That's why there were so many unnecessary hysterectomies, unnecessary cesarean sections, overuse of hormones during menopause. We didn't know that then. But as we made common cause with researchers and with those in the public health field, we began to learn a lot more. But it wasn't just about empowering us to make good personal decisions that mattered. Yes, we each wanted to make better decisions. We also wanted to change the circumstances under which we got medical care. We wanted to make sure that we could change the whole pie, not just get a piece of the pie somewhere. And that's when we started to look at the social, political, and economic context in which women's lives were lived. That's when we started to work with women in the prison. For 3 years, another woman in our group and I taught a women's health course at MCI Framingham. One of the striking things I learned there is that a book like Our Bodies Ourselves could become a literacy tool. Remember Paulo Freire, if you really want to know something, you'll learn how to read. The book in Spanish has been used as a literacy tool as well. We all hunger for this information. And we also have to make sure that we get care with dignity, that it doesn't matter what our race is, what our background is, our age, our degree of disability, our sexual preference, our class background. These were often reasons to be discriminated against. They still are. But as we got together and as we broadened the voices that were included in our bodies ourselves over the many, many decades, we began to realize that we won't make a better society or a better healthcare system unless we are more inclusive and that everyone's voice is heard. I think this is one of the reasons why 3 years ago the U.S. Library of Congress named Our Bodies, Our Cells as one of 88 books that shaped America. And it's not just because we learned some more. Well, thank you. It's really about the communitarian values that this book embraces, always has embraced. It's about helping one another. It's not about individualistic solutions. Yes, we can eat better if we have money to go and buy organic food, but what we have to do is stop the pollution of the environment. We have to make sure that the food supply is good for everyone, and the air we breathe, the water we drink, you can't always control that. So there are many solutions that are not going to be individual. They're going to be collective, they're going to be communal, they're going to be community, state, national, and international solutions. And what's so exciting for me is that Our Bodies, Our Cells started out to be a U.S. project, but the book has traversed the globe. Women in so many different countries came to us and said, we want to translate that book. We want to translate and adapt it culturally. Now it appears in more than 30 foreign languages and formats, and in the pipeline are a Farsi edition, a Turkish edition, most recently a Vietnamese edition. And these are not just books or now online materials. These are resources that are used by women to advocate for themselves, for their children, for their families, and for their communities. And in some sense, I think Our Bodies, Our Cells was the best embodiment of the women's movement. Remember that Women's Liberation Conference? So many women were discovering then that the personal is political. And the personal still is political. Actually, right now, maybe more so than ever. And maybe more so than ever, we need groups like Our Bodies, Our Cells. Just look at what's happening to Planned Parenthood, which needs all our support, I believe, at this moment. Yes. And it's very interesting because when we first got going, and at that conference where women were gathering together, someone had an abortion story, someone had a story about getting contraception. Even married women had trouble getting contraception in this state for a long time. In fact, when I was going to college as an undergraduate in Cambridge, I didn't know that when I went to Harvard Square to Dr. Funkhauser, a wonderful man who gave me my first diaphragm, that what he was doing was not even legal. And it turned out to be a long while before we could get legal contraception for unmarried women. So many stories like this still persist where we need to bring about change. And I think this is one reason why our global initiative is taking new forms all the time, why we're inviting our partners here, why we go there, and why we're trying to make sure that this kind of advocacy, this kind of excitement, is more inclusive rather than less inclusive. More than 300 people worked on the last edition of Our Bodies, Our Cells, some of them physicians, some of them researchers, some of them community workers, but they all are part of a community. It takes a community to do a book like this and to create a movement like this. And we invite all of you to participate. Right now, I'm living with a little trepidation. I stepped down in January as executive director. I'm joining the founders and the board and the staff to make sure that this organization will be sustainable. But all small nonprofits have real challenges, and books like Our Bodies, Our Cells don't sell like they used to. So we have to find new ways of producing income to keep this kind of advocacy going. And believe it or not, I never thought I'd learn how to run a crowdfunding campaign, but I'm doing that with some of my allies. I never thought that I would spend so much time on college campuses, but I know that is where the action is. And I am so inspired by the younger feminists that I meet. And they're not just women, they're men too. And I'm really proud, all the young women and men, and I'm so happy to meet Lori tonight too, which was really a treat for me, that this kind of activity isn't going to stop. When I think about what we put into this movement, this book, and when I think about how close we are as women, Our Bodies, Our Cells group, we've lost a few of us, but we're still very close, our families are close, We have Jewish holidays together. We celebrate so much together because of our close personal relationships. It's sort of like what Hiawatha was saying. It's so important to connect with everyone around you. One of the things I also understood early on is that we're not accidentally a group of 8 Jewish women, an Armenian woman, that's me, and 3 other women who actually were rebelling in some ways from their roots. It wasn't an accident because we knew injustice from a young age. I saw it in the town of Watertown where I grew up, where one of the first black girls to join me in the 8th grade was denied admission into Rainbow Girls. Of course, some of us up and quit at that moment, not even realizing that we had been part of a racist institution. And I think that's part of what we have to make sure we do, that we show one another the truth of our lives, that we don't allow one another to move on with blinders on, so that we can make the kinds of changes that come about only when we link hands together and go forward. Thank you.
That's Judy Norsegian. I should mention that some of the authors here tonight have books for sale on a table in the back, and if you're extremely old, like me, you might want to kind of take a trip down memory lane and check out that first 1970 newsprint edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves. My uses for that book, I think, are somewhat suspect, but I was a devout reader of it. Trust me. I learned a great deal. Alone. But make sure you check that out. And there's also some very cool information about Our Bodies, Ourselves, the organization's programs. It would be the right time to connect with such a group and support such a group. You made very subtle allusion to what's happening around the efforts to defund Planned Parenthood. If anybody wants to see the kind of negative analog to becoming informed as a collective, just take a look at a little bit of tape from those hearings. They're utterly fraudulent and kind of sad that they're at the congressional level, although utterly predictable. All right. Our next storyteller, Ben Mezrich, has created his own highly addictive genre of nonfiction, chronicling the amazing stories of young geniuses making tons of money on the edge of impossibility, ethics, and morality. Ooh, that sounds yummy. Or just like America. Ben is the author of 16 books with a combined printing of over 4 million copies. Bringing Down the House, the inside story of 6 MIT students who took Vegas for millions, spent 63 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, and his book, The Accidental Billionaires, The Founding of Facebook, A Tale of Sex, Money, Genius, and Betrayal, hit bestseller lists in over a dozen countries. The book was adapted into an Oscar-winning movie, The Social Network. Perhaps you've heard of that. Written by Aaron Sorkin and directed by David Fincher, Ben and Aaron Sorkin shared a prestigious Scripter Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. Ben appears regularly on TV and has several film and TV projects in the works. His new book is a story about obscene wealth, crime, rivalry, and betrayal from deep inside the world of billionaire Russian oligarchs. It's called Once Upon a Time in Russia. I am so excited to hear him speak. Please welcome to the stage Ben Mezrich.
Hi. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much. I just want to start off, this is not part of my story. What's going on with my glasses is not a fashion statement. I was playing with my 5-year-old and got knocked over, and now I feel like Piggy in Lord of the Flies. Like a rock is going to fall on my head, and I have no depth perception, so I'll try not to fall on you. I have spoken in this room before in the beginning of my career, and there were 4 people here, and 3 of them were looking for the food hall. So 2 of them left to get a hot dog. I don't mind if you leave and get a hot dog in the middle. A lot of people always say something like, life happens for a reason. Everything happens in life for a reason. I feel like in my life and in my career, everything's kind of happened by accident. I never wanted to be a journalist or a nonfiction writer. There are people who say I'm still not a journalist or a nonfiction writer. But I never wanted to be a nonfiction writer. I hated nonfiction growing up. I loved TV, really bad TV. Shows like Saved by the Bell and Three's Company. My parents, fearing the worst, made a rule when I was little that we had to read 2 books a week before we were allowed to watch TV. So I became a speed reader and fell in love with books so I could watch Saved by the Bell. By the time I graduated from college, I realized I wanted to be a writer. I locked myself in an apartment a few blocks from here, and I wrote 9 novels in a year, not something I recommend for anyone. They were deep, dark stories that took place in bars in New York City because I was reading Bret Easton Ellis at exactly the wrong time in my life. I was rejected by everyone in publishing, got 190 rejection slips, had them taped to my walls like a serial killer. I was even rejected by a janitor at a publishing house because I sent a manuscript to an editor who was no longer working there, and it got thrown in the trash, and the janitor took it out of the trash, read it, and then rejected me. I kept going. My dad is a doctor, so I decided I would try and write a medical thriller. So I wrote a book called Threshold. It was my first published book. I think I was 25. None of you ever read it. It sold 3 copies. It got me a second book called Reaper, which was about a computer virus that makes the jump to the biological world and people start getting sick from their TV sets. And I came up with the idea after watching a bad episode of Oprah. I can say that. She doesn't have a book club anymore, right? So I can say that. That became a really bad TV movie called Fatal Error. I hope none of you saw that. It starred Antonio Sabato Jr., remember the underwear model from Melrose Place? He played a surgeon, which was very believable casting. I didn't know surgeons did so many sit-ups in between each patient. And I remember watching that movie with my dad, and there's a scene where he's leaning over a patient's chest, and he goes, "We've got a subdural hematoma." And my dad turned to me and said, "You know that's in the head, right?" Anyways, I was a struggling sci-fi writer. Nobody was reading my books. And I used to hang out in a local bar, an MIT dive bar, called Crossroads, which is, you know, a lot of you are MIT people. It's full of kind of geeky people. I'm geeky, so I can say that. And there was this group of kids who hung out there who were just like everyone else, but they had tons of money. And it was all in $100 bills. And the thing is, in Boston, you never see $100 bills, right? In New York, you see $100 bills. In Vegas, they come out of the ATM machine. But in Boston, you never see hundreds. So I went over to the main guy, and I'm like, "Why do you have all this money in $100 bills? And he said, "Come over to my apartment." So I went to his apartment in the South End, and it was way too nice for an MIT kid. And he points to his laundry. And in his laundry was $250,000 in stacks of hundreds. So I immediately think, this kid's got to be a drug dealer, right? But he didn't look like a drug dealer. He was real geeky. He was Asian. I didn't even know if there were Asian drug dealers. And I was like, "Why do you have $250,000 in your laundry?" And he's like, "Well, come to Vegas with me tomorrow." So I got on a plane and I flew to Vegas. And there were 5 of his buddies on the plane, and they all pretended they didn't know each other. We landed in Vegas. There's a limo picks us up, takes us to a suite in a big strip hotel. We had a swimming pool. We had a butler. I didn't even know what to do with a butler. We have a butler. And the MIT kids start coming out and pulling money out from under their clothes. And they pile it up on the table, and it was $1 million in cash. And they said, "We're the MIT blackjack team." Now, I'd heard of something called the MIT blackjack team. I thought it was like a math class at MIT where they learn how to play blackjack. But the truth is, this had been going on for 25 years. One group of students would train the next group of students and the next group of students the secrets to beat the game of blackjack. And this group I had met had won $6 million playing blackjack. And I was blown away because it was better than all the crap I'd been writing, but it happened to be true. So it became my first nonfiction book. I wrote an article for Wired magazine about the story, and I was sitting at home watching Saved by the Bell. And the phone rings, and it was Kevin Spacey. There was a guy who said, "I'm Kevin Spacey." And I said, "No way," and I hung up on him. And I called my mom, and I'm like, "Mom, Kevin Spacey's trying to call me." And she's like, "No, it's the MIT kids prank calling you," because they used to prank call me all the time. But it really was Kevin Spacey. I flew out to L.A., and he says, "I want to make a movie out of this." I'm like, "Okay, that sounds great. Let's make a movie." So he takes it out to every studio in Hollywood, and every studio rejected it except for MGM, which happened to be the casinos that we were hitting as the MIT blackjack team. So I was like, how did that, why do you want this movie? Are you really going to make it? And they said, we love your story because it makes people think they can geek the game of blackjack. And I always see people reading the book on the flight to Vegas, and I feel so bad. That's the worst time to read my book because you're going to lose. You actually have to be so perfect that you can't make one mistake an hour, or it's worse than not card counting at all. Anyways, we're about to have this big movie premiere in Vegas. And again, I'm sitting at home watching Three's Company, and I get a weird email from a kid from Harvard, and it says, my best friend founded Facebook and no one's ever heard of him. So I had heard of a guy named Mark Zuckerberg, but that wasn't this guy's name. So I went out to a bar at the Westin, and this kid walks in, and he's Eduardo Saverin. A lot of you have seen the movie. He looked like Andrew Garfield, not quite as good looking, kind of ugly Andrew Garfield, you know, Hollywood. Like, that was the best looking group of MIT kids ever in the movie 21, wasn't it? But anyways, he walks in, and he sits down, and he has two drinks, and he says, Mark Zuckerberg fucked me. And I said, tell me more. And he starts to tell me that crazy story, you know, two geeky best friends who couldn't meet girls. Mark goes on a really bad date and gets home and then hacks into all the computers at Harvard, pulls up pictures of every girl on campus and makes a website where you can find out who's the hottest girl at Harvard. He was even comparing girls to farm animals. And when he got caught, he said, well, the girls were beating the farm animals, so I shouldn't get in trouble. And that shows you his social awareness at the time. Anyways, he makes it into the newspapers and catches the eyes of the Winklevi twins. You could not invent these guys if you wanted to, right? 6'5", identical twin Olympic rowers, the cool kids on campus. They were members of the Porcillian, the ultimate finals club that goes back 300 years. The rumor at the Porcillian is if you hadn't made your first million by the age of 30, they give you $1 million. I don't believe that's true. The Winklevi, I remember meeting them in a hotel room. I was with my wife and Cameron or Tyler. I mean, who can tell, right? One of them says, you look at us and you think we've got to be the bad guys in this story because if this were an 80s movie, we'd be dressed as skeletons chasing the Karate Kid around the gym. And I actually put that in the book, and Aaron Sorkin put that in the movie, and then Ralph Macchio called me and was like, I love that we're talking about the Karate Kid. But anyways, the Winklevi were working on their own website. They see Mark in the paper, so they hire him as their geek. Mark doesn't think much of them, but, you know, plays along. Then he goes to his friend Eduardo and says, I've got an idea for a website. If you put up $1,000, you can be CFO and have 30%. No lawyers, you know, there's no papers. He puts up $1,000, the greatest investment in the history of the world. And Mark builds Facebook. It spreads all over, gets to Stanford, and that's where Sean Parker comes into the story. He's the cool kid of Silicon Valley, the Armani suit, but he's got the EpiPen in his pocket because he's allergic to everything. He's the kid who founded Napster in high school, and that was sued out of existence. And then he founded Plaxo. And then he was caught with cocaine and got fired from Plaxo. And then he was the first president of Facebook until he got caught with cocaine. But it wasn't his cocaine. It was allegedly cocaine. Sean was the cool kid. He sees Facebook and he says, I want to be a part of this. And they start leaving Eduardo behind. Eduardo freaks out, freezes their bank accounts. They fly Eduardo out to California. He meets with some lawyers and they make him sign something that dilutes him to zero. He goes back to Boston, realizes what happens, and sues Zuckerberg. The Winklevi, who are off rowing in the Thames, did I say it right? They sue as well because they're not a part of Facebook. And that's where I came into the story, right? No one was supposed to be talking to me. Eduardo was in the midst of this lawsuit. He had come to me to try and force Facebook's hand. Well, I thought this is a great idea. I wrote a 14-page book proposal. It leaks onto the internet on Gawker.com. Suddenly, everything goes crazy. Facebook settles with Eduardo for $5 billion. The first page of the settlement agreement says, you may never speak to Ben Mezrich again. Literally. He sends a restraining order to me. He breaks up with his girlfriend because it's my wife's best friend. And he moves to Singapore, never to be heard from again. No, I'm not angry. For $5 billion, none of you would ever talk to me again either. I think my parents would probably never talk to me again. Anyways, this is all interesting. Meanwhile, Aaron Sorkin reads my proposal on the internet and calls up and says, I want to write this as my next movie. Wow, right? David Fincher sees it on the internet and calls up and says, I want to direct this, but we have to do it right now because who knows if Facebook will be around in a year. So I'm like, wow, this is all awesome, except I haven't actually written a book. So I locked myself in a hotel in Boylston, and in 3 months I wrote the book. Aaron Sorkin came to the hotel, and the next 3 weeks he wrote the movie. and it became The Social Network. And my life changed again. And so when people say, you know, life happens for a reason, I like to say, for me anyways, it happened mostly by accident, and mostly I owe it all to two shows, Three's Company and Saved by the Bell. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Oh, my gracious. My mother, if she was listening to that, would walk up to Ben and say, you know, you're a nut. You go putt-putt. That's just what she would say. That was completely crazy. And I think the lesson is just spend a lot of time in bars, it seems to me, is kind of the moral of that. What a great story. Okay, our last storyteller of the evening is Tom Ashbrook. He is the award-winning host of NPR's On Point from WBUR, Boston. Yeah. And that is heard for 2 hours across the country every day. He's a former editor and reporter at the Boston Globe. He spent 10 years in Asia. He began his career in journalism at the South China Morning Post. He's worked as a dynamiter in Alaska, a producer of Chinese kung fu films in Hong Kong, an internet entrepreneur out of Boston, and a farmhand in Illinois. Yeah, big deal. Who hasn't worked as a dynamiter in Alaska? He is the author of The Leap, a memoir of love and madness in the internet gold rush. He's also one of the most articulate and morally grounded voices in American media today. It is a great honor to close this evening's program and welcome to the stage Mr. Tom Ashbrook.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Steve. Thank you. Oh, my gosh. Mark Zuckerberg fucked me. I got nothing, Ben. I just have a short story. You're all very patient, and it's wonderful that you're here. I can't believe I'm standing here. You know, we're in Faneuil Hall, and this is like, didn't George Washington stand here or something? People come here from all over the world, all the time, and we don't really know how they got here, and we don't know how they make sense of Boston. And I was asked to tell a story. I want to tell you a story about a very brief chapter in my life when I was that guy. Speaking of gambling, you know, journalists, like gamblers, look like poker players. We look for the tell. And this story, in a way, is about what the tell was for me about Boston, that ever since has been kind of my passkey to understanding this place as a journalist and as someone who has adopted Boston as a home and feels beautifully adopted by Boston and very grateful for that. Long, long ago and far away, I lived on a little island in the mouth of the Pearl River between Hong Kong and Macau with a beautiful French immigrant girl. And we lived in a compound with our Chinese landlord and landlady. It had a goldfish pond with a bridge over it and those Chinese lions on top, and a little dog named Latiu, chili pepper. And my landlord would shower right behind our shower in his shower and sing Chinese opera, and life was beautiful. Out the back terrace, we could see Hong Kong in one direction, a beautiful mountain of light, and the other direction was the open South China Sea. And we had been in Asia for about 5 years. Every morning, we would kayak around the island in the South China Sea. It was a great community there of artists and journalists and bohemians and drifters and writers and probably some spies. And then every day we would take the ferry into Hong Kong, an hour in, and Danielle worked for the United Nations. In those days, the boat people were coming up from Vietnam. They would come right to the shores of our island, little sampans with Samsonite luggage in the middle. If they hadn't been raped and pillaged and killed and sunk, they would arrive, and lots of them came. And she helped run a couple of the enormous camps in Hong Kong where they prepared to go on out into the world. And I worked, as Steve said, for the South China Morning Post, which is a totally fantastic place to be at that time. China was just opening up in a tiny little way. When we got to Hong Kong, if you wanted to see China, this is almost impossible to imagine now, you had to go out to the edge of Hong Kong where these Hakka ladies had duck ponds, and they would rent you binoculars, and you'd stare across the water, and they'd say, China. And that was it. That's all you could really see. But by the time I was at the Morning Post, you could start to go in. Hong Kong was a really vibrant place. There was a lot going on. There was a trickle of old kung fu movies coming out of China. And we would get these in all kinds of different dialects of Chinese, many of which we couldn't even understand. And we'd put them on a big moviola where you'd load the film on and then crank it with your foot. And you'd see them slowly talking in these kung fu films. And many of them were not Cantonese, which I spoke some of, or Mandarin, which my colleagues spoke. They were other stuff. And my job was just to sit there, among other things, was to sit there and watch their mouth move without having any idea what the film was about and write a script of words that would fit their mouths and then make it hang together through the course of the film. And then we would get into the Diamond Hill Movie Studios, where Run Run Shaw made Bruce Lee famous, and they were now abandoned except for us. There were rats crawling in the old velvet curtains at night, and we'd go there with a couple of big whiskey bottles and a movie projector and cut it into 2-minute strips and project these up with, there was a little squad of us, most of them were British actors and actresses and me, and then we would mouth the words to fit what we had written for their mouths on the screen, and it was pretty fantastic. Some of those sex scenes were just amazing, and we got really good at the la 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 stuff. And then we would sell them in Jamaica and Nigeria and all the third world English-speaking places around. Anyway, it was fantastic. We were kind of living a dream, but there's a certain point when you're living abroad where you think, how long do I want to be abroad? And this was beginning to percolate in our minds. I know for some of you this date is going to be shocking, but this was in 1980. And we'd been abroad 5 years, more or less, at that time. And so I'd go to the South, into the newspaper, and we'd do our work every day, and it was great. There were huge characters there. All the copy editors were from India and Pakistan, and all the really flamboyant writers were from Australia and New Zealand. And we had great Chinese colleagues there who just taught us everything that we hadn't learned yet about Hong Kong. It was the early days of computers, and we typed on computers, which was very exotic at that time and also kind of a fragile undertaking. And every day at 5:30, which is when we'd be about halfway through writing our stories, a big siren would go off and red fire alarm things would go in the newsroom, and you had to save your news story for the next day's paper very quickly because they were about to dump the classified ads in. And if you didn't save your paper before the classified ads came in, it was all lost. So then there would follow 30 minutes of classified ads groaning into these old computers, and we would all rush down to the little bodega and pop open the biggest beer that we could drink in half an hour or several and tell stories and have a great time. The big star at the newspaper at that time was a guy named Kevin Sinclair, and he'd been in Hong Kong for many years. He was a Kiwi, New Zealand guy. He could take anything. I was in awe of him and turn it into this amazing, pulsating page one story. He was a great, great, great news storyteller. But he had a thing about smoking. He could not stop smoking. Under the glass of his desk were these enormous, bright, colorful pictures of completely cancerous lungs. And he would stare at them, and he couldn't stop smoking. And while I was there, he had a tracheotomy. And he'd been an expat for a long time. His sidekick, Jimmy, was with him a lot, who would help him after his tracheotomy do his interviews because he was learning how to speak through this hole in his throat. He had to sort of learn to belch his words. But we would all go down to the bodega and drink beer, and he still had the bandage over the new hole in his throat, and they were telling old war stories, and it was all so great. But then Kevin, after a couple of beers, would lift the bandage and smoke through the hole in his throat. And I thought to myself, you know what? Maybe it's time to go home. And so then the question was, where do we go? Because, you know, I was a Midwestern kid, and she was a French-German immigrant girl, and she had grown up there but could go anywhere. She wanted to get into the world of academia one way or another, into college land. And so she wanted to go to grad school, and it came down after she sent some applications out to Harvard or Stanford. And you always wonder, how do people make these decisions? You know, there's a billion of them out there right now in China and, Poland and all over the place, thinking maybe about exactly that. And we just couldn't decide, and we couldn't decide. California sounded pretty great and warm and sunny and Beach Boys and all that. And Boston sounded pretty smart and pretty appealing, a lot of history. And we went back and forth, and what finally decided it was Time magazine came out, and they said the 10 best newspapers in America was the cover story for some reason, as I recall, and on that list was the Boston Globe, but not the San Francisco Chronicle. So we came to Boston. Yeah. December 9th or so was our last day in Hong Kong, and we got on the ferry in the evening, as we always did. It was a great kind of hour-long ride back to the island with all of our chums who would be on there. We'd sit on the poop deck and drink beer and watch the sun over the harbor, the trademark harbor of Hong Kong, where you could see what Hong Kong was all about, ships and trade, 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 trade. And we were going back to America, and we'd been abroad for years, and the news that night that everybody was just stunned by was that John Lennon had just been assassinated on the streets of New York. And we thought, you know, wait a minute, maybe it's not a good idea to go back. What kind of country are we from that can happen? That's just too crazy. But the wheels were all in motion, and we flew home, spent Christmas on the farm in Illinois, and people wanted to know, you're going to Boston? Boston, well, people talk funny there, and what's that really about? We didn't really know what it was about. We really didn't. We needed a car, so we went to the bank. We bought a repo from the bank, a little Ford Fiesta, named it Trixie. And we needed furniture. My grandmother had passed away, and so we rented a U-Haul truck. I remember, 9 feet 6 inches tall. 9 feet 6 inches tall. Remember that. And, yeah, I was that guy. We filled it with my grandma's furniture. And we were all excited. Again, young people, I'm sorry, but in those days there weren't any cell phones. But there was this thing called CB radios. And Danielle's dad was a French engineer, beautiful little cookie duster mustache, thick French accent, patents all over the wall. And he was all excited about CB radios. And so she was going to drive Trixie, and I was driving the U-Haul truck. And we had CB radios, and we would talk to each other all the way out. And, you know, when this started off, this was very jolly and very funny. We were making jokes about, you know, like off-color jokes on the CB radio. 10-4, good buddy, about Paul Revere and his horse. We just kept making, for some reason, that was our meme on that trip. Really dirty jokes about Paul Revere and his horse. Because we're going to Boston, you know. And what do we know? And somewhere around Chicago, I started losing her, and I thought she was behind me, so I slowed down more and more and more. CB radios did not have much of a range. And pretty soon I was saying, speed up to her. And I was on the interstate going like 20 miles an hour, and she was gone. And I lost my lover, and I didn't know how to find her. It's a different world without cell phones. I mean, now that's just not an issue, but I just pulled over to toll booth. And anyway, she hadn't been behind me. She'd been in front of me, and I was saying, speed up, speed up. And by the time we found each other, with a whole lot of old-fashioned long-distance phone calls, she was in Ohio, and I was sitting still in Chicago. We caught up. We stayed with my old minister in Cleveland. He went on to write a great book with Dominic Crossan about the historical Jesus that I read till the pages fell out of it. We drove through unbelievable snowstorms around Buffalo. The snow was higher than my 9'6" truck on both sides of the highway. The snow continued all the way across upstate New York. We came into Massachusetts for the first time. On the Massachusetts Turnpike. Never been on it before, the Pike. And, of course, you see Stockbridge, and, of course, we're that generation, and we're on the, you know, CB radio, you know, Birches look dreamlike from Stockbridge to Boston, on the count of that frosting. And she's, you know, with 10 miles behind us, 10,000 more to go. Boom, on we went. We stayed overnight in Amherst with an old friend from University of Illinois whose husband is now de Blasio's chief of staff in New York. It's funny how life unfolds. And we drive on into Boston. We really didn't know much of anybody, but we had a couple of strong pegs here. And one was a wonderful family on Beacon Street that my editor at the South China Morning Post, who collected chinery, which is paintings, old paintings of China, and whaling pictures, and he knew a family called the Lothrops. And I didn't know. He just gave me an address and said, look up Mrs. Lothrop. And so we knocked at this door on Beacon Street. It's right across from the common. It's one of those fantastic tall brick townhouses there. And a Scottish maid opens the door in a full, you know, maid's outfit and takes us up this huge stairway with beautiful etchings of old whaling scenes all along it. And upstairs is McGeorge Bundy's mother-in-law. He was National Security Advisor to Lyndon Johnson, and it's Miss Lothrop. She looks like Katharine Hepburn. And there's two great fires going, and she's incredibly elegant and incredibly old Boston. This is the first person we sat down with in Boston with our U-Haul and our in Trixie parked on Beacon Street. And we had the most fantastic evening. She was so open and generous with her. Her husband came down later. He had emphysema at the time. Wonderful guy. He had a Swedish rolfer who just rolfed him all the time so he could breathe. And she and Danielle became great friends. They would go to the Somerset Club and eat rabbit and stuff. And we were looking for a place to stay. And she said, well, one of my maids has an empty apartment in Somerville near Davis Square. That house made my fortune. But not like Ben's fortune, of course. But so that was kind of an amazing night. And then we went to see my great old friend from college who happened to be, and now we're getting closer to the tell, our tell, my tell about Boston. His name was David Levitt, and he happened to be studying for one of the first PhDs in artificial intelligence, I guess, under the great and fabled and enormous figure Marvin Minsky at MIT. Yeah, yeah. So we went over to Harvard Street behind MIT, which, unlike now, have you been over there? I mean, it's just transformed. It's like you're on another planet where everything's steel and glass and beautiful. MIT has just rippled out in this very, very snazzy place. But then it was just like three-decker things full of cockroaches and grad students. And that's where we stayed with David. And he took me into his lab, the AI lab, I guess it was called, and he had a list machine, this really crazy computer, and he was they were doing early packet switching, and he was talking about something that many years later I realized was the thing Al Gore invented or whatever. It was like, it was ARPA and DARPA, and it was like early internet. And I was dazzled by this. I still didn't really know what was going on with Boston. And we were, Danielle and I were saying, and then was the night, and then we'll get out of here. We kind of figured it out. It was within those first few days that we were in Boston. And David said, hey, there's a party going on tonight. Let's go over. It's at Minsky's house. And it should be fun. And so, you know, I love David and whatever he suggested I would do. So we went. Marvin Minsky's house was and is, I was just there a few months ago again, on Ivy Street in Brookline. Sort of not far from Fenway. I mean, it's within a 10-minute walk from Fenway. And it's this great old magnificent pile of a house, looks sort of like the Munsters' house or the Adams family's house on the outside. When you go in, it's the Adams family's house. Like there's a trapeze in the living room, there's books piled everywhere, there's this great old organ where he improvises, you know, Bach-style fugues. Try that. And a huge wrench, as I recall, over the fireplace, like a 6-foot-long, real heavy steel wrench from, I don't know, building the Golden Gate Bridge or something. And in the middle of the living room, there was great music as we came in, and people were dancing. And we thought, this looks fantastic. But then we realized it wasn't really just dancing. They were making a human machine. And everybody was like, you know, somebody was like a hole, and somebody else was screwing into it, or there was a lever. The whole thing was like this the human Tetris game where everything fit together and all the pieces, all the people were functioning as a kind of an improv machine together. And, you know, we came to party and now, or dance would be great, but, you know, and I think for a lot of people, this is sort of what approaching Boston feels like. There's this cool thing going on, but what the fuck is it? And the hard thing about Boston, but ultimately the really satisfying thing is that to get into the dance, you actually have to stand there and think a little bit. Like, how? What? Oh. Oh. And then, how am I? Okay. You know, and then pretty soon you're figuring out that move, whatever it is. But you have to think your way into the dance. And before that night was over, and Minsky had come out and done his Bach fugue thing, and you know, the guy that Isaac Asimov said was the only one of only two people in the world smarter than himself, it was Marvin and Carl Sig, and I think he said. Who knew? We still didn't know much of what was going on, but this was our introduction and our tell about Boston. It's a beautiful dance. You have to think about how to get into it. A week later, I took the Red Line out to JFK Columbia Station and walked in the snow. I remember the snow got in my shoes, walking over to the Boston Globe and snuck in and found somebody who knew somebody in Hong Kong and eventually got a job there. And Danielle did her grad school time and eventually became dean for international students at MIT, where thousands and thousands of other people from around the world came through her door to figure this city out. And I'm sure they all did it in their own way. And I am sure that for all of them, it's something like dancing and really thinking. And then you're part of Boston. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Tom Ashbrook. All right, folks, I think we'll just real quick, before people head for the exits or head for the keg or head for the giant dancing machine that we will later reenact right here with Tom Ashbrook right at the center of it, I just want to thank all of our storytellers tonight. They were fantastic. Every one of them brought it, and they should get a big round of applause. And just a quick shout out to all the folks at Hub Week, Harvard, MIT, Mass General Hospital, the Boston Globe, the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard, and the Shorenstein Center on Media, and also Samantha Henry at the Nieman, who helped put this together, along with Genevieve Sponsler, who was the director and producer. You guys did great. Please hang around a little bit. Thank the storytellers. Talk with them. Talk amongst yourself. And please get home safely. We'll see you next year. Take care.